Well, good morning, everybody. Off to a good start for the Sabbath already. Beautiful full moon last night. Wasn't that great? We were out there on Mount Seifert, is what we call it now, for the teen camp out there at John and Connie Seifert's place. And we're up on the hill above the house. So we were sitting on Mount Seifert and had a teen Bible study after they had eaten roasting ears that we cooked over the fire. And I think they had nachos for the rest of the dinner and just admired that gorgeous moon. It was just clear as a bell. And, of course, as Mark pointed out, Harold's the Trumpets is only 2 weeks away, a fortnight away. It's interesting, fortnight. What's with the British? Don't they count days? They count it by nights. That's what it means. It means it's the first part of 14, fort, and then tag on the nights. That's how they say 2 weeks. We say 2 weeks, they say a fortnight. But you know, that I think is a remnant of understanding that their calendar was originally lunar. And thus they referred to things as a fortnight, 2 weeks. So it's a fortnight to Trumpets. You wouldn't know if it was 14 days or 2 weeks to Trumpets. Because if you went out and look in the daytime, you wouldn't see when the new moon was coming. It comes on the new moon. And the feast starts on the next full moon. So, marvelous time. One last tidbit. I did bring Holy Day forms with me. So if you need those for school or work, which is requesting excusal from work or from school, then just check with me afterwards. I'll sign the form. You fill in the rest of the dates and other things and sign it yourself or sign it for your school-age youngsters. All right, well, we're off into, I think, what is one of my favorite sermons to give, and I recently had an excuse to give it, and I thought, well, why not have a couple more excuses to give it? Here today, this morning, and over at the camp out this afternoon, I want us to try to imagine something. Turn, if you would, to Hebrews chapter 4. Fourth chapter of Hebrews, verse 15, is where we're headed. There's a lot of things that happen in God's church and in God's way of life. You know, we're busy. We're coming, we're going. We've got things happening right now. We've got the feast days coming up. And we'll be thinking about what they mean, the return of Christ, pictured by the Feast of Trumpets and the millennial rule of Christ by the Feast of Tabernacles and the removal of Satan by atonement. Atonement pictures more than that too, but it certainly pictures that. And then we've got all the business of getting ready to go to the feast and packing things, and that's busy. And then we've got Spokesman's Club and Teen Speech Club starting. By the way, we postponed the start of the Teen Speech Club till after the feast as well. Those will be starting right up afterwards, and we have the blessing of little children, and we have this, and we have that, and next week I've got to go down and shoot 3 commentaries at home office and take a camera back and possibly shoot some camp video footage, narration footage. I've got a few things popping and jumping around as well. It's a busy time, and when we get busy, we don't stop to reflect. Last night it was a little bit fun because even though it was a late night, I didn't get back home till after 11. After doing the teen Bible study. But at least we got to sit there on the hill and look up there at the 2 or 3 stars, and I don't even think they were stars, I think they were planets, that we could see in addition to the moon. We would have seen more, but we're sitting under a yard light, and that kind of washes the stars out a little bit. And then the moon washes the stars out to begin with. When the moon's full, you don't see as many stars. But it was at least a time to stop and imagine. And the kids, they had a, what did I do with the assignment? You'll find this interesting. This is a digression, it's not part of the sermon, so please don't get distracted. How can a young man or woman cleanse his or her way? What does a young person really need to know about God's truth? What do you need to know first, then second, and then third? Suppose that as a group, you were designing a new website for teens in the church. What would it look like? How would you prioritize the Bible educational part? What interesting add-ons would be useful? And then I told them to please read Psalm 119. A little smiley face. All 176 verses of it. I said, all you have to read is from verse 9 to verse 40 to begin with. So we were actually waiting around in Psalm 119 during the Bible study. And But we got into the discussion of how would you set up the, with this scenario of developing a website just for the teens in the church, an internal website in that sense. What would be the priority points to cover in Bible education? What does a young person need to know first, second, and then third? So we reasoned that out a little bit, and they came to the conclusion that they needed to prove God's existence. So then we talked about, okay, what do you see right here from Mount Seifert that immediately brings to mind a proof of God's existence? And we had a lot of things. There were lots of bugs, little bitty bugs, and they... Somebody mentioned the bugs. You know, they're so small but so complex. You know, that couldn't have just happened. You know, then somebody talked about the stars, somebody about the moon, and somebody about this, that, and the other thing. Finally, we got clear down to irreductible complexity. And I know you'd have loved to get in on that discussion since, you know, we're all experts in it. You are, you know. Somebody brought up the eye. I said, so what's important about the eyes as far as proving God's existence? And they stared at me with a bovine look. Have you ever seen the bovine eye, a cow's eye? You don't see the white around their eye very much at all. And it's just all the center of the eye. And it's all brown and very shiny, almost liquidy brown. And I used to talk to the cows when I was haying them or feeding them. You talk to the milk cows all the time. You call them boss. You treat them with great respect. And if you don't, they kick you. Step on your toes. I had that happen a lot of times. Knock your bucket over. Whatever that, you know, they're in charge and you just live with that. But you talk to the other cows and the calves and they just stare at you with this big bovine eye look. So I said, so what is it about the eyes? And I got the bovine look. They didn't know. I said, actually, the eyes are one of the major proofs of God's existence. And the people who will reluctantly admit that, although not saying it in that many words, are the evolutionists themselves. They don't know how eyes exist. Because eyes are not eyes until they are completely there. So how can you have a gradual development of an eye when you can't see a thing until the whole thing's there? See, that's called irreductible complexity. In other words, you take any component away from the eye and it's not an eye and it doesn't work. So then they realized they did know what irreductible complexity was after all. So now you do too. It is actually an intelligent design. That's one of the things that really irritate the atheists, because scientifically they know it's true. And it counteracts everything Darwin stood for. So the complexity of the eye, irreductible complexity, has a nice roll to it. All those syllables just coming and going. Well, where were we? We're up on Mount Seifert. We talked about that. Then we talked about the need to prove, you know, for the website, the prioritizing the Bible educational part. We need to be able to prove that the Bible is God's Word, the divine inspiration of God's Word. And then from there, you could open the book. Actually, it's a library. You know what? Jerome was a Latin historian, a Roman historian in the 400s AD. And he referred to the Bible as the La Divina Bibliotheca. Divina means divine. Bibliotheca means library. The divine library. I mean, it's a library with 66 books in it. Well, historical documents, because you can't really say that Paul wrote books. He wrote epistles. And John wrote epistles, too. And John wrote shorter ones than Paul did. So you open it up, though, and then suddenly you have this vast array of knowledge and things to cover in the website. And so then they came up with some other things. And I asked Stephanie Martins to be the secretary and write all that stuff down as they were sort of discussing it in the discussion portion of the Bible study. I said, have them tell you all those things they said tomorrow morning and write it down in a list. Might be useful. You know, we are revamping our web presence for the church. We're doing a lot of creative work on some of the front end first contact websites, newverticalthought.org. We'll have one on creation versus evolution. We'll have a variety of websites, plus probably a newsroom website, which is the news presented from the angle of understanding God's Word. So we'll have all of those things that we're trying to get the working models up so that the administration and the council can look at them, and we can, and approval can be gotten to move ahead with the various ones. So, you know, we're in website development. Thus, it was a natural thing to shape the Bible study in that way. Did you find Hebrews chapter 4? I'm going to go back to the sermon. In verse 15, it says, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." Now, that's a reference to Jesus Christ. Here's what I want you to try to imagine. What would it be like to try to relate to somebody who never sinned, who never made a spiritual mistake? Because sins aren't just mistakes. They're violations of the divine law. How do you relate to somebody? Now, you can see that there's potential there, because he can sympathize with what we face. Okay, so we know, well, that he comes more than halfway toward us. But how do we personally, from our minds to his, relate to Christ? The hymn we sang a few minutes ago that Mike picked out, As a Deer, I think he just picked it because of the title. We're closing in on that time of the year. But the lesson in that hymn is quite fascinating. You know, it's talking about a personal dedication and relationship to Jesus Christ. And it waxes eloquent on it, actually. It's a very beautiful hymn indeed. So how do you relate to someone who never sinned? Now, maybe you could relate to someone who is an adult who hadn't sinned, because you just kind of block out, okay, he's a perfect person. And he was, in every way. He couldn't have been the sacrifice for our sins had he not been perfect. But let's step it back a ways. You know, many here are parents or are grandparents, but there are a few of you who are kids. And, you know, by kids, that's kind of a relative term. You know, what do we mean by kids? Under 30 or under 20? Now that I'm getting on toward where I might have a gray hair someday, I'm beginning to think that kids are a lot older than they used to be. But that's the way it goes, I guess, with all of us. What was Jesus Christ like as a kid, though? And I'm talking under 20. We figure he was responsible. He was a full-fledged, firing on all cylinders adult from 20 on. But he didn't live very long. His life, human life, came to an end at about age 33. So, what was he like as a kid? Hence the sermon. Welcome to a sermon called Jesus Christ as a Kid. That's the title. Jesus Christ as a Kid. And you think, well, we don't really know that much about Christ as a kid. We know he did something when he was 12. But that's it. All right, well, let's look at what he did when he was 12. And let's see if that, in fact, is it. Let's go to Luke chapter 2. That's where that comes from. Matthew records the birth sequence of Jesus. He has the wise men that come from the east. They would have come from Parthia, the empire of Parthia. That's what was east of Judea at the time. But Luke deals with the birth of Christ too, but he deals with a different aspect. Matthew did not cover these points. Bear in mind that God inspired the records to various of the four accounts. Certain of them conveyed certain things, and other ones conveyed other things. So we'll look at this in Luke chapter 2. We want to we'll pick up where they have Jesus as a baby. And we'll skip over Simeon. I'll have to let you read verse 25 to 35 on your own later. It's quite interesting when you stop and think about the ramifications of what he said. He was a prophet. But there was a prophetess. There weren't many prophetesses in the Bible, but there were a few. Now, that didn't mean that they were preachers in that sense, like the men were. But it did mean that they were inspired by God to convey certain messages to certain people. And so this one was named Anna, In verse 36, the daughter of Phanuel, of the tribe of Asher. She was an Asherite. Now, most of the tribe of Asher disappeared with the 10 tribes of Israel, long lost to most historians, only findable to those who know how to track the tribes. And Asher actually is easy to track. The continent of Asia was named after some of the descendants of Asher, called the Asi, or the Asians. And ultimately, Asia initially was what we call Turkey. Now we call that Asia Minor, and then the rest of Asia is Asia Major. But the title seems to have derived, actually, from the tribe of Asher, from the name of Asher. She was of great age. She lived with a husband for 7 years from her virginity. So if she married at 18, that would have been 25, and then she was 84 years a widow. So either she was 84 years old, or she was 105 years old, one or the other, or so, 109, I forget. I don't do math well. Who did not depart from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. For how long she had done that, possibly 84 years, we don't know. But she dedicated herself to whatever service needed to be done. And she came at that instant. She knew Simeon. And she gave thanks to the Lord and spoke of him, Christ as a baby in Mary's arms, spoke of him to all who looked for redemption in Jerusalem. And there were some who knew that God was intervening in world affairs and in the affairs of man, and that there was a Messiah coming. There were some who were seriously looking, and there were others who were only politically looking. But it was partly because of Anna's and Simeon's comments that the reputation, plus the shepherds, that the reputation of the Christ child grew. Of course, that ultimately led to the genocide of the boy babies under age 2 in and around Bethlehem, ordered by Herod, and that's another story. So when they had performed all things according to the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee. Now, Matthew will tell you that they went to Egypt first, and they stayed in Egypt, we don't know how long, a year, part of a year, maybe several years, because of the genocide of the boy babies in Bethlehem. Now, Luke skips over that part. Ultimately, God gave, inspired Joseph to know it's time to go back, and then they went right back to Nazareth where they came from. And they returned to Galilee, to their own city, to Nazareth, and the child grew. Now we have something. We're gone past the baby stage. Now, technically, a baby is a kid, but we're starting now to get some inkling of the personality. And as you watch a tiny baby grow, they have personality very early on. But when they hit 1, and then when they hit 2, and the personality, from what child development experts say, is set, 90% set at about age 3. That's the fundamental personality. Now, the message for parents is, age 3, huh? You mean I don't just change diapers and stick a bottle in the mouth and wait until they're old enough to be interesting to take an interest in them? No, you start early. Shaping, molding, talking, teaching. Because you want to shape that personality into a healthy, strong, perceptive, gentle, and yet exuberant personality. And if you wait till after 3, it's like, kicking the bedpost in the night. Stubbing your toe, as far as child rearing goes. So I'm sure Mary and Joseph had, some inkling of that. That's it. The child psychologists have studied that, but there were plenty of people who just knew that because they're wise down through time. There are plenty of people who didn't know that, and the reason they didn't and didn't act on it is because they were unwise. So we want to be wise. The child grew, and he became strong in spirit. So that will include the toddler years. He's growing. He became strong in spirit. There was a dynamic personality there. Energy that was a driving force. If he fell down, he got up. He wasn't weak in spirit where he fell down, he kind of give up. No, he fell down, he would get up and he would go. He was filled with wisdom. How do you have a child filled with wisdom? Well, I can show you a few examples. You know, our kids here, for their age, are filled with wisdom that their peers don't have. Now, sometimes it's like pulling teeth to draw it out of them, and sometimes it's not. Jesus said, "Do not forbid the little children, but bring them to me." We do that at the blessing of little children, the second Sabbath after the feast. And we read all those scriptures where Jesus told them, because the disciples didn't want the little kids hanging around. I mean, the boss was too important, you know, and so, and then he got mad at them. He got mad at the disciples, and he says he rebuked them sharply. That's getting mad at them, you know, in our modern parlance. And so he let the kids come, and he would talk with them, and the parents wanted them, you know, to bless the children, because Christ was a rabbi, he was a teacher. He was respected by those who knew something about him, and not respected enough by some who should have known more about him, having been around him all the years that he grew up. So he grew, he became strong in spirit, filled with wisdom. You know, Jesus used reference to the little children. He used referred to the psalm that says, "Out of the mouths of infants, praise to God is perfected." Well, actually, it says in the King James, "Out of the mouth of babes," but that just doesn't cut it in the age of, you know, the bimbo age that we live in. They don't seem to be wise. It's out of the mouths of infants. That's the kind of babes we're talking about. But praise to God is perfected. In other words, children, often, if they have been encouraged to be perceptive early on, are. And they have some remarkable wisdom. And yet Christ had wisdom far beyond even that. And the grace of God was upon him. Now that means God's divine favor. He was blessing him, guiding him, amplifying these, you know, his experiences. So that's an inkling. That's what he was as a little kid. Now we come up to age 12. And you think, well, at age 12 is still a little kid. I told our teens last night over in Columbus, I said, "Did you know that before World War II, you didn't exist? I mean, not you personally, I mean your age group. There were no teenagers before World War II. Nobody thought about being teenagers. When you hit about 12 or 13, you worked. You may have gone to school, but you worked before and after. You were a young man or a young woman. You were a young adult at age 13, or roughly bar mitzvah time, and the Jews have had an inkling that that's a turning point. Actually, it is. Personal identities are formed during the time of age 12 to 13. And that's where people chart a course in their life. If you try to chart the course of your child's life after that, again, you just stubbed your other toe. It needs to be started much earlier as a parent. So teenagers didn't exist. After World War II, America became fairly affluent, and suddenly they decided that they would have to pass child labor laws. Child labor laws were fine up to a point, but they outlawed a lot of regular work that kids could have done and would have learned a lot of good things from. They had a lot of free time because their parents had more wealth as the nation was prospering, and thus they developed the teenagers so that they could market stuff to them. Which, of course, they do in a huge way now, but they began to do it in a significant way by the early 50s. So the concept of being a teenager is fairly recent. Actually, Amanda wrote a Vertical Thought article on that a few years ago. If you search the site, you'd find it, I think, interesting. She gives more of the historical data about it. So he is 12 years old. Up to 12, this is what we see. And that seems like not very much to tell us about what Jesus Christ as a kid was, but maybe we can extrapolate from that shortly. Let's look at what happened when he was 12. His parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. They kept the holy days, all right? According to the custom, it was the routine, just like our kids have that routine of keeping God's annual festivals. And when they had finished the days, as they returned, the boy Jesus, so here he is a boy, as he hasn't reached age 13 yet, lingered behind in Jerusalem. And Joseph and his mother didn't know it, but they just supposed him to be in the company, and they went a day's journey and sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. It was the crowd that was traveling north. Ultimately, they were with the group that were going to Nazareth, but there would have been a huge crowd of people moving north to the various towns and cities in the north of the country. And when they left, he wasn't immediately at their side. They weren't worried. The crime was not as perhaps bad then as now, as far as crimes toward children or young people went. But he was responsible. They didn't have to worry. He's with somebody, and we'll find him at the end of the day. So they didn't even give it a second thought. They just expected him to be with some one of the families, which meant that he was responsible and gregarious. He wasn't going to be off on his own, lost someplace because he wandered away, didn't want to be around people. He'd be around people. They just knew he would because he was typically around people. And he was responsible and would do the right thing. And at age 12, they knew that. So now you begin to realize, well, we do know a little bit more about him as a kid. And Joseph and his mother, anyway, they get down to verse 45. When they didn't find him, then they started to panic a bit. Uh-oh. As parents, what kind of parents are we? We didn't check and see where he was when we left yesterday morning. So they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. Now it was that after 3 days, and I presume not seeking him for 3 days, there was a 1 day out, and then it would probably they made that trip back in a half a day. And then they spent a day and a half looking for it. So a total of 3 days. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, the leading rabbis at the time, the finest minds that Judea could produce. And the temple was, for all practical purposes, the university of Judea. That's where you went to learn. That's where the rabbis taught. Some rabbis might have been priests, others Pharisees. Maybe some were neither, priest or Sadducee or Pharisee. But they were there, the leading minds, a collection of them, and he was sitting in the middle of them, listening to what they had to say and asking them questions. Well, that's interesting. Typically, a kid that will go and talk to adults, in too many cases, they either want to say everything or not say anything. And yet, here he will listen and then he'll respond. So at age 12, he is commanding the respect and attention of these much older men. A priest would probably, he would retire from the active priesthood part of the sacrifices and such at age 50. Then he would have additional time to build on the education he already had, studying of the Torah, as they would refer to the Bible in the day. So these men would be older men. And he's sitting here carrying on a very erudite discussion. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers. He would listen to them. He would ask questions. They would listen to him. And then they would ask him questions. He would answer the questions and then respond back. It was a give and take discussion. Baffling. A child prodigy, for sure. Except more than that. And so when they saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said to him, "Son, what are you doing? Why have you done this? Look, your father and I sought you anxiously." The typical mother response, you'd expect that. You should. She should respond like that. And he said to them, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" And you think, now he's speaking respectfully. Why did you seek me? What were you looking for me? Didn't you know this is what I would be doing, looking after my father's business? Bear in mind, they had received personal prophecies of this child before he was born. Gabriel was sent to Joseph and to Mary, explaining that they were going to have a son, and he was going to be really the most amazing son the world had ever seen, and still is. So when he says, "Why did you seek me? Didn't you know I should be around about my father's business?" They had an inkling. There were times it says that Mary didn't fully comprehend what all this was about, but she hid those things in her heart for later on. And then later on you saw that understanding blossomed in her life and in her mind. But this is our key, the key section about what Christ was like as a kid, both as a little child and then as, you know, beginning of his teen years. And he went down with them to Nazareth. Nazareth is north, but it was downhill, even though it was in the hills. And he was subject to them. In other words, he was a faithful son, but his mother kept all these things in her heart. Why did he say that? That's really odd. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. If he increased, that meant that he already had some, which is verified by verse 39. Before he was 12, he was wise, but he increased in wisdom and in stature, in both physically and in respect, thus in favor with God and men. So we see that as a little child and then as an older child, a younger person, a kid, as we might refer to a young person, a teen, he was very wise, remarkable. Now, that meant that he had to study. That meant that he had to do what he did with the teachers of the law. He had to listen. So you begin to see a child that listens, but isn't afraid to talk. Not an introvert, but not an extrovert that, you know, you can't shut him up to where you can teach him anything more. He struck the balance. And he thought about things. And he was obedient. Subject to his parents in that way. And subject to God, most certainly, who is his ultimate parent. And his personality was a pleasant one. Is one that people enjoyed being around. He grew in favor with God and men. Now, when you look, have you ever taken snapshots of your grandparents or great-grandparents, if there were some snapshots of them? And usually they're in those little Browning box cameras, and so the pictures are small, and they might be brown-toned or they might be black and white. And you take that picture, and hopefully it's in focus, because the ones that are out of focus are really frustrating. The ones that are in focus, you start studying not just the expression of the face and the clothes that your ancestor was wearing at the time, but what were the things around them? What did the building look like where they grew up? What kind of, if there was a shot where they were maybe working, what kind of tools were there? What did all the detail that you start wringing that picture out for every little detail you can find, because you know that all of that has some impact on what they were like when they were young. I don't know if you've ever done that, but I do it. You get a magnifying glass out and you look carefully all around them in addition to looking at them so you can glean as much as you possibly can from that little snapshot. Well, we just looked at two snapshots of Jesus Christ. And so the same principle applies. We want to wring everything we can out of that passage. It's a word picture, if you will, to try to deduce what he was like as a kid, as a young person. And you think, well, okay, well, we've got quite a bit so far, but that's about all we can get, right? Well, no, let's go someplace else. Let's go to Mark chapter 6, because here we have another comment that obviously carries some history with it. His ministry has started, so he's at least 30 when this occurs. And you think, well, what if he's 30? You know, how does that tell me about what he's like as a kid? Well, because the comment has historical significance. Is why. For some reason, I can't stop in Mark. I go from Matthew to Luke. Mark chapter 6, it's near the beginning of it, before he walks on the water. Okay, he went out from there to his own country, that means back to Galilee, and his disciples followed him. Now that basically, the first bit just tells us the setting. He went back to Galilee, into Nazareth, and when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue. Okay, so what are you going to wring from this picture? Well, he taught in the synagogue as a young man. Now, did they just have somebody they knew nothing about say, well, it's your turn to teach in the synagogue. You're going to teach this coming Sabbath. No. There's history there. Here is a one who has grown up there. He clearly knows the Scriptures, can expound the Scriptures, and so he was asked to teach. And many hearing him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? Okay, so now we've got the element of surprise. They knew that he knew how to teach from the Word, but now he's saying things that are so profound that where did he get this stuff? Did he go off to university like he did when he was 12 again? You know, for all of 3 days? Now, talk about a leadership weekend. That would be a leadership weekend for Christ back in the time that he was, 12 years old. We usually let him mature a bit more before we send him down to the home office for the leadership weekend. Where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him that such mighty works are performed by his hands? Because they knew of the healings and such. So they're baffled. We know him. How can he say these things and do these things? It's just a carpenter. We're in Nazareth. So we come to the next statement in verse 3. Is this not the carpenter? The carpenter? He probably had the business where he was a primary carpenter in the village, in the town. And so people needed things fixed. He could fix them. Isn't this the carpenter? The son of Mary? No mention of Joseph. You're studying the photograph, no mention of Joseph. What happened to his human dad, his stepdad, and for him, his case? Well, if he wasn't mentioned, he would probably died. Joseph, we know, was a good man, a very good man. But it is apparent that God let him die young, relatively speaking. And in the overview of things, you could see, well, that's logical, because then Christ would have to be the head of the household as the oldest son. It would put a certain responsibility on him sometime when he was young. We don't know if that happened when he was a teen or in his 20s. But we do know that by sometime before his ministry started, he became, as far as the earning, the wage earner, he became the head of a household. He had to provide for the family. He had a responsibility that was upon his shoulder. He understood what it was like to have to take care of a family. And he's the brother of James and Josie and Judas and Simon, 4 brothers. And are not his sisters here with us? So he had at least 2 sisters. We don't have their names, but there are at least 2. There might have been 3, we don't know. But there are 4 brothers and 2 sisters. And Joseph didn't die completely young because they had at least 7 kids. Counting Jesus, 6 of those that Joseph was the father of. But they said, we know him. There's this family here. He's the carpenter. What is he saying these things for? Who does he think he is anyway? And then they got nasty, and they were offended at him. And that's when Christ said, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. Don't get no respect there. Pardon the English, or the French, as the case might be. But you can see from this, he had a family. And you think, okay, all these brothers and sisters, so what does that tell me? Well, they aren't, quadruplets, the boys. And the sisters, we don't know if they were twins or not, or triplets, but it's doubtful. They were probably single births. Probably. Now, maybe there's a set of twins in there. We don't have any idea, except that we do know that when there were twins, they were usually referred to as the twins, or the twin. In fact, one of the disciples is called a twin. So this, therefore, is probably all single births. And you say, well, what difference does that make? Well, he was a brother growing up with younger brothers and sisters. He had responsibility to look after them, like older brothers tend to have. And he had to share with them. And he had to interact with them. He wasn't cloistered by any means. He was busy in the middle of things in his family. So he grew up in a large family setting. That's important. That gives you an inkling of what he was like as a child. He had to blend with the group. Our kids come to camp, at summer camp or winter camp, and they get tossed into a new family for a week. They're dorm mates. And at winter camp, we mix the age groups. So you have one or two of the older campers, and then we just go right down through the age groups that we have there from 12 to 18. And each dorm has a cross section. I think Pinecrest does that. Most of the camps, we mix them by age group, so they're with their specific age groups. But in a couple of the camps, we don't, because it actually works better for the program that we have there to have the age mix. And it's a good experience. Either way, it's a good experience. They suddenly have all these new brothers or new sisters that they have to get along with in close quarters, and it's a wonderful learning experience. Well, Jesus learned about that too, because he had a pretty large family that he grew up in the middle of. All right, now that gives us some direct inkling. These are good snapshots to tell us something about what he was like as a kid. We're going to summarize some of the things that we learned, but there are more snapshots than this. Let me give you one that's in Luke chapter 12. Tell me what you could learn from this snapshot. Verse 54 and 56, it's just a short one. Then he said to the multitude, so this is in the middle of one of his teaching sessions, whenever you see a cloud rising out of the west, immediately you say, there's a shower coming, and so it is. And when you see the south wind blow, you say, there will be hot weather, and there is. You know why there's hot weather when the south wind blows there? Because it blows off of Arabia, the desert wind. It's hot. And there is. Hypocrites, gets to the point, this is the commentary on the weather report. You can discern the face of the sky and the earth. How is it you cannot discern the time? Or this time? Referring to the fact that he's the Messiah and that time in history has arrived. Now you think, so what does that tell me? Well, it tells me that Jesus understood the weather patterns. He understood how weather came and where it came from. He was, at the very least, an amateur meteorologist. At the very least. But there's a fair amount of detail implied here and in other similar comments. And you think, so what does that tell me as a kid? As a kid, he noticed things. South wind, going to be hot. Or he'd see the cloud coming and he'd gather his littlest brothers and sisters and head for the house, we're going to have rain. When the cloud came from the west. He observed things. He paid attention to the natural surroundings. That's what it tells you about him as a kid. You know, some kids, they're only interested in what other people think about them or about their group and, you know, this little chit-chatter type of thing. They don't seem to pay a lick of attention to what goes on around them in the natural world. He wasn't one of them. Much more watchful and thoughtful. And you think, that's interesting. That would be good to be, more watchful and thoughtful. Let's move forward to chapter 13. There's another short snapshot here, verse 1. And there were present in this season some who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. So we had some people from Galilee who had somehow got crossways with Pontius Pilate and came down to offer their sacrifices and must have started a little riot. And the Romans didn't care for riots. They tended to go kill the rioters, and that would quiet the riot. Riots were not part of the Roman tolerance level. So then Jesus answered and said to them, do you suppose that these Galileans were worse sinners than all other Galileans because they suffered such things? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will likewise perish. Or he said, he didn't stop there, making his comment on the tragedy of these Galileans. It may have even happened, you know, fairly recently. He said, or those 18 on whom the Tower of Siloam fell and killed them. Do you think that they were worse sinners than other men who dwell in Jerusalem? I tell you, no, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. And yet, so he knows current events. How many people were killed by that Tower of Siloam? 18. You notice that? Of those 18? Not only did he know the current events, he remembered pertinent details. He was well-versed in what was happening. He paid attention to things. You think that he only started doing that after he got to be over 30, when you couldn't trust him if you were a hippie? Remember, the hippies had a saying, never trust anybody over 30. They kept revising that now, and now they're all over 60. No, Christ was completely aware of what was going on. He watched the news. If there was news to watch, or he listened to the news, some of it you actually saw happening around you, and some of it you had to hear from others. He was aware of things. That had to be a habit that got started early. Talk about the importance. We have talked about the importance of early childhood development before age 3 and then before age 13. Well, at those times, he was very watchful and very much soaking up the detail, learning things, paying attention to things, and not preoccupied with popularity and social issues. You know, there's enough, you can get to deal with that, but don't get preoccupied by it. Back in chapter 5, here's another good one. See, basically what you do is you take these snapshots, verbal snapshots of when Christ was in his ministry, and then you extrapolate backwards to get an idea of what he was like when he was young. And when you realize you can do that, then suddenly you can get a fairly detailed picture of what Jesus Christ was like as a kid. It's really quite amazing. Chapter 5, start right in verse 1. And so it was, as the multitude pressed about him to hear the word of God, that he stood by the lake of Gennesaret. It has another name that you know it by, the Sea of Galilee. And he saw two boats standing by the lake, and the fishermen had gone from them, and they were casting, washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, that would be Peter. Peter is the nickname he gave to Simon. And asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and he taught the multitudes from the boat. Why did he do that? Well, okay, you have a big crowd, they all want to hear what he has to say. And they're crowding him to where very few can hear what he has to say. So he looks around and he's resourceful. He says, empty boats. So Peter was probably one of the men fishing right there that was washing his nets while he was listening to what was going on. And so he asked him to let him get in the boat. And he says, now pull away from the shore a little ways. Then he could use the water to bounce his voice off of. And of course, you've got the slope coming down, the ground coming down to the lake. He had an automatic amphitheater. Suddenly his voice could reach hundreds and hundreds, maybe a little bit more than that, just by doing that very simple thing. He understood some of the facts of science, practical. And he was resourceful. He could say, let's do this. And it worked. That's pretty amazing. And when he stopped speaking, he said to Simon, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Let's go fishing. And Simon said to him, Master, we toiled all night and we didn't catch a thing. Nevertheless, because you said to, I'll do it. And he put down the net. And when they'd done it, they had caught a great number of fish and their net was breaking. So they signaled to their partners, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, on the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. And then Simon Peter saw it. He fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. He knew that was a miracle. Now, good fishing usually is because of good sense. You know where the fish are. Peter obviously didn't know where they were. But he realized he had met the master of bass fishermen, or whatever it was kind of fish they had, perch, I think, is what they had mostly in the Sea of Galilee. And Christ knew where the fish were. And he realized that there was something very different about his friend who, it would appear, he had known all his life. There is some commentators think that James and John, who Christ affectionately called the sons of thunder, Boanerges in Greek, were actually cousins, that their mother was a sister to Mary. That's what some commentators think. And it's possible. So he didn't just stay always in Nazareth. He was back and forth. Those fellows lived down on the sea because they were fishermen, or on the lake. And Nazareth is 4 or 5 miles up the hill. And when I say up the hill, it's probably not even above sea level. The Sea of Galilee is 767 feet below the sea level, at the surface of the Sea of Galilee. So you've got to go up a lot of hill before you actually get to sea level up in that area. Nazareth was, I think, below sea level itself. I don't think it had gotten quite high enough to be above it. So here we find he understood about fishing. And all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken, and so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon, and Simon's brother, which is Andrew. And Jesus said to Simon, Don't be afraid. From now on, you will catch men. I will make you fishers of men. So when they brought their boats to land, they forsook all and followed him. He had a personality that inspired confidence, but this is somebody they knew. What they didn't know is that he knew where the fish were and the fish did what he said. That was the implication that Peter was, it frightened him. Now, you say, so what does that tell me about Christ as a kid? He liked to fish. He liked to talk. He liked boats. Oh, that says a lot right there. These are some of his best friends. A couple of them probably his cousins. So we know that he was back and forth, you know, coming down to visit them and see them. We know later that Jesus had a home in Capernaum, which may have been where that was. I'm not sure if it told which town that was in. That he owned a home down there on the lake as a young man. So this gives you an inkling of what he was like when he was a teenager and younger. Very active, busy, new people. He had friends. Cousins and friends who respected him, and suddenly they realized they needed to respect him even more. And he commanded that respect in a proper way. Now let me show you one other fascinating thing. This is back in Matthew, and Matthew has a lot, but we'll just pick this one thing so that we can press on to the summary of what we've learned about Jesus Christ as a kid. It's in chapter 23. Someday, I'll just give a sermon on Matthew 23. It is, you know, some people seem to thrive on confrontation. And they're really tedious to be around. They like to argue all the time. You know the type. But Christ knew when it was time to confront and when it time was not to confront. Matthew 23 is confrontation start to finish. And it's interesting to understand the concept of it, and we'll go through this someday in detail. He was a week away from his crucifixion. It was time to push the buttons. And we know why we use this saying, well, he really knows how to push people's buttons. He was pushing button after button after button, just hammering them in to set in motion the antipathy of the Jews, which was always there. Now, that's a whole other story, and it shows you an inkling of his humor and his ability to, you know, have a wry wit and sometimes a cutting wit when it was necessary. But it's verse 37. It's after this repartee and this give and take with Pharisees and the Sadducees throughout the chapter, he comes down to a moment of reflection. The mood changes from one of laughter and hard confrontation to one of sadness and longing. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, verse 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house has left you desolate, for I say to you, you shall see me no more until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. You know, he looks at Jerusalem, because that's where he is at the time, and he mourns for his city. How long I have wanted to gather you together, like a hen gathers her chicks. How long had he wanted to do that? Since he was 12? No, probably since David sent Joab up the water spout to take the city of Jerusalem. Probably that long. He wanted to gather Jerusalem together like a hen gathers her chicks under her wings to protect them and care for them. You know, this. He's got a. Bear in mind, Christ knew who he was, and he had a historic memory. He studied the history, but he knew that he was the one that dealt with David. He was the one that dealt with Moses. He was the one that dealt with Abraham. He was the one that dealt with Solomon and Hezekiah, Josiah, and the other good kings. And the bad kings, too, for that matter. Because they mostly were bad kings. And so he was mourning. And you see, whoa, there's a deep emotional well in the person of Jesus Christ as a young man and in his 30s. Deep emotional well. Where does that come from? Just all of a sudden? No, no. When you study how a person reacts emotionally for a little while, you can see a history there. We're all history books, in a sense, for those who have eyes to see. You know, there's a proverb that says, counsel runs deep in the heart of a man, and a man of understanding will draw it out. There are two men mentioned there. One is the man who has the counsel. It's emotional, it's mental, it's, you know, his thoughts and his feelings all wrapped together. And then there's another man who knows how to draw that out. He's a counselor. And he draws it out, and the implication is for good. Help people sort out what they're thinking. Well, Jesus was a very deep well. He was also the counselor, because he's called Wonderful Counselor in Isaiah chapter 9. But here he is mourning for Jerusalem. So you see the dedication and the love he has for his people and for the country and ultimately for all of mankind. For Jerusalem will be the banner for all the Gentiles as well as the Israelites in the age to come. And you know what else that this tells you? You look at it. What else did he learn when he was young that is from this snapshot? He understood chickens. Why would he use that word picture? Why would he use that analogy? He understood exactly what a hen does with her chicks. Probably bannies. Because they have about 5 times as much personality as regular chickens. You know, I almost feel bad when I would kill one, you know, to have for dinner. We had a banny hen. We had about 500 or 600 bannies that ran loose all around our building site when I was growing up. We started out raising specific varieties. So we had millefleurs and golden seabrights and black rose combs and silver spangled Hamburgs. And then we got busy after 2 years of keeping them separate so that we would keep them all separate varieties. And we just let them be bannies. And so then we had the millefleurs crossed with the, you know, silver spangled Hamburgs, which are a black and white, beautiful bird. And then the golden seabrights or the black rose combs and mixed around until you basically had jungle fowl. That's what they are from India, jungle fowl. And they were the best setting hens in the world. We could, you know, they would defend their nests to the death if need be. And they would hatch anything you put under them. We would mow through our alfalfa fields, mow through pheasant nests and sometimes a duck nest. Nobody else did this in the entire neighborhood, but the Stivers always did it. You get off at the tractor, you go back and see if there are any eggs that didn't get broken. And if they were, you picked them up and put them on the engine cowling, you know, in a container where they would stay warm until somebody brought you iced tea from the house. And then you'd send those eggs back and put them under one of the setting hens. We always kept about a half a dozen setting hens in a pen so that they were always there ready to go. And in they go, and they'd hatch pheasants, and then we raised pheasants all around the yard. But the duck ones were funny. The one hen hatched a batch of ducks. This was our first experience. The one egg was broken, but the nest was destroyed, and so the mother duck couldn't come back. She could go lay a new batch. Well, we saved those eggs, put them under the hen. She hatched about 10 ducklings. Little mallards. And she was so proud. Banny hens are, you know, there's nothing prouder than a banny hen with a batch of baby chicks, newly hatched. She came strutting out when they were ready to go, and here they come waddling along in their tiny webbed feet, and they make these funny sounds, and you could listen to her cock her head, and something wasn't right. The sound didn't seem right, but they were her chicks. They were going. So she'd come to an area where there was a little bit of grain or something. She would scratch and cluck to get the chicks. It's a clucking sound which they'll respond to, and they'll start pecking at things. So she's showing them where to find food. Well, these ducks wouldn't peck. They would go along. You know how ducks will go like this, and they'll nibble at it and let it go. She stopped and looked at them. We were standing just a few feet away watching this whole drama unfold for all morning long. And so then she would take them from place to place. Finally, they wandered all the way out, about 80 yards from the pen, out by the mailbox in the county road. And we would always get our rain in the spring, and then we didn't get any after that. There was a mud puddle there that was about 40 feet long and 12 or 15 feet wide. And at the deepest, it was about a foot and a half or so deep. And it lasted most of the summer, part of it did. And so she happened to come along there, and those little ducks saw water. And you know this is programmed, you know, instinct, because she didn't know anything about them being ducks yet. And they all started beating their little tiny wings and running, you know, all excited. And they dived in the water, and they hit the water and just swimming like crazy. You know, they were in their element then, finally. She went berserk. Squawked, clucked, commanded, cajoled, scolded, and they wouldn't pay any attention to her at all. And she's jumping up and down on the bank trying to get them. We're standing here just watching this from 6 feet away. Finally, she panicked, and into the water she went. Bannies can swim, too. She swims just not as efficiently, no webs. So she was paddling for all she was worth, and she went from duck to duck. Oh, they would just swim around her and cluck to mama, and they were happy she'd come in to go swimming with them, but she couldn't get them out. So finally, we got a little concerned that she was going to get exhausted, so I waded in and picked her up and set her on a bank again. And she, after a minute or so, she got up and shook the water off her feathers. If you could see a dejected chicken, this was one dejected chicken. She just literally shook her head and walked down the ditch bank. The ditch was just the next thing over, about 10 feet from the mud puddle. And ate some grasshoppers. That was what she did every day. She'd bring her chickens, her little ducklings out, and turn them loose in the water, and she'd walk away and come and get them in the evening and take them back to the pen and, you know, sit on them and gather her chicks under her wings. It was a hard year for her. I don't think she was ever right in the head afterwards. But there were others. There's one other chicken story. And Christ knew these things. You know, you've got to know chicken stories if you can toss out this kind of an analogy. And it tells you a lot about his childhood when you realize this. We had a banty that was the most protective hen we ever saw. If we were going to give a medal to one of the hens, this one would have gotten it. We had two dogs for watchdogs, German Shepherd. She usually left Smokey alone, but Shad was a Shetland sheepdog. So like a small collie, a beautiful tan collie fur and a white band on his neck. And he always, since he was a tiny puppy, always slept at the corner of the house. Always. That was Shad's spot. He was always there when he wasn't running around doing things. And the main thing he ran around doing was chase the chickens out of the garden. He never killed any. He tried to once, and we punished him, and so he never killed them, but he would terrorize them. He could chase them back and forth because he was a herding dog until they were panic-stricken and flew over the fence, which was all 2 feet high, or until he caught them. And he would drop them over the fence. You know, they would be exhausted, and they'd just lay there for about 15 minutes before they could get up and go again. He'd chase them back and forth. So Shad had a reputation, we'd have to say that, with the chickens. This banty hen, and our hens gathering eggs when we were kids, you didn't go to the chicken pen and gather the eggs. Oh, you get three or four there. No, it was always a safari. The bannies laid their nests of eggs wherever they wanted, mostly in the haystacks. So we would have to hunt the haystacks. Any hole that looked like a chicken could get in, flashlight, yep, there are the eggs. You know, there were two there yesterday, and there are five there today. So you gather the eggs. Well, they would do that when they went off to hatch their chicks. They would find some weedy spot and around the edge of the yard, and we had plenty of those, and they would lay their eggs in a nest there and hatch their eggs. This hen would hatch her eggs over someplace behind the house. We never could figure out where she had them. She raised two batches a year. And the first thing I remember watching this happen, she had her tiny chicks, and you can tell how old they were based on, you know, how much fur or fuzz versus feather there is. They were right out of the eggs. She came around the house, and that dog was sleeping right in his spot. And she looked at him and squawked and attacked him. Literally attacked him. She jumped on his back and pecked him on the back of the head, and he took off running up out of a deep sleep and ran toward the corrals because he was sort of aimed that way. And she hung on, and that long fur, she could get a good grip, and she pecked and squawked and flapped her wings the whole time. She was about 80 yards away. She finally let go and flew off and flew back to her babies and carried on with her day. Every time she came around the house, she would do that. Until the chicks were big enough, they needed to socialize with the other teenage chicks, and then they'd go around to the chicken pen on the other side of the barn. And she would raise two batches of chicks. That poor dog, he'd sleep with one eye open. You know, looking with the direction she usually came, and the only time she'd surprise him then is if she came around the other way, around the house. So, you know, to be able to talk about chickens, like Jesus talked about chickens, man, they had to have chickens when they were kids. He understood wood, he understood stone as a carpenter. He grew up being a carpenter and doing all those things with his father, with Joseph, before Joseph died. Now, back to our summary. We realize now that you can tell a lot about Jesus Christ as a kid from these snapshots. Let's do a summary of some of the things. And I have one more snapshot to look at in a minute. He loved his folks. And he was one who had a deep love for his people. Obviously, the Jerusalem snapshot indicates that on the larger scale. That kind of dedication starts with dedication to family. He was obedient. He was respectful. We know that. He worked hard. He understood how to work. He was a carpenter, after all. That included working with masonry. That included probably the ability to fall trees and cut them and split them and make lumber as needed. There were no Lowe's and the Home Depot's around in those days. You had to go and do most of that yourself. And he knew how to do it. So he was capable with his hands. He understood the workings of wood and of stone. As I say, carpenters did all of that in those days. He understood how to use tools. He knew how things functioned. The wood, the stone, the steel, or the metal. I don't know if they had steel, but they certainly had iron in that time. He was physically fit. Because he worked hard, supporting his family meant that he didn't sit around and watch TV all the time. He was up and doing. Walked all over the country during his ministry. He was a walker. Now, that would naturally be from his youth, because if his cousins lived on the lakeshore and their father was a fisherman, his uncle Zebedee, then Christ was in Nazareth, up way up in the hills a ways, then he was back and forth, coming and going to see family and to be down there and do things. So he was fit, very fit. Plus, we didn't read about this, but he drove out the money changers twice during his ministry. So, he had to have an imposing view. He was physically clean. He washed the disciples' feet. He let a lady wash his feet with her tears. Remember that. He grew up with his friends who were fishermen in the Sea of Galilee, so he swam a lot. How do you know that he swam a lot? Okay, well, I'm going off of what his friends did. If you remember, after Christ's resurrection, he told his disciples, "Meet me in Galilee. I'll meet you up there shortly." Several weeks yet before Pentecost. And when he got up there, he called out to them early in the morning, and this was a repeat of this scene we read about. They were fishing all night and caught nothing. And so he called out to them from the coastal fog, and he asked them, "Hey, children," which was a friend, a greeting, "have you caught anything?" And they said, "Nothing." They didn't know who it was at first. He said, throw your net on the other side of the boat. Like he had a fish finder in his mind. And they threw their net on the other side of the boat, and they started pulling it in, and it was burgeoning. It was a casting net. It wasn't a seine. They would throw casting nets. They basically, you're hunting for fish, and the net drops down because it has weights around its round perimeter. When you throw it, it opens up. And it drops down, and the weights are dropping faster. And then when you think you've gone down far enough, you've got a cord connected to the outer edge of that net, and you yank the cord, and it pulls it together like the drawstring on a bowl or a pouch, and the fish are caught in the net. Well, they had a huge catch, and they're dragging the net between two boats to drag it into shore, and then Peter recognizes who it is. It's the Lord. So he dives into the water and swims to shore. Now, why would he dive in the water to swim to shore? He was enthusiastic, Peter was. They swam. Undoubtedly, they all swam. And I think it's safe to reason that Jesus was a swimmer as well. He loved the outdoors. He knew where to find the fish, just case in point I told you about. He knew all kinds of things about agriculture and wildlife and the weather. He could predict the weather, as we've seen. He fished and he ate meat. So he wasn't a vegan. So he was strong and he was healthy and he understood the importance of first-class protein. That's all the amino acids, all the essential nine amino acids that make up the essential ones that you find in meat. He was trustworthy, loyal, honest. Parents weren't alarmed when he left Jerusalem without him. He was respected by his friends. He had a keen intellect. He knew the Bible backwards and forwards. He could articulate intelligent questions. He knew a lot about science. We already covered some of that. Up to date on current events. We talked about that. Oh, he knew a lot of things. He was also funny. He was even witty. Let me show you. This is our final snapshot. It's in John chapter 2. And when I talk about the humor of Christ, I've given the sermon on the humor of Christ, haven't I? Here. Okay. It was probably a couple of years ago. I could actually give two or three sermons on it. But this is one incident of his sense of humor, which you don't necessarily realize is there until you start reading between the lines a bit. He had gone someplace, and on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Cana's about 4.5 miles from Nazareth. And the mother of Jesus was at the wedding, and now both Jesus and his disciples, now we're in verse 2, were invited to the wedding. So, they had friends. They got invited to weddings. Well, that's interesting. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now, you have to understand, she's a Jewish mother. And the Jews have a strong family ties. Historically, they have had. And the proverbial Jewish mother is a classic case. You know, there's a funny story that Isaac Asimov used to tell about this Jewish mother on vacation with her son and his family, and they're in the out at the swimming pool of the hotel, and he slips and falls into the pool and bangs his head, and he's floating in the water unconscious, and she goes running back into the hotel shouting, "Quick, quick! My son, the doctor, fell and hit his head." She had to mention he was a doctor. You know, it wasn't enough to just dial 911. No, she had to dial 911. He's a doctor, or he's a lawyer, or he's a scientist. You had to get in the status part of it, what he'd accomplished. She was proud of him. So Mary was proud of Jesus, undoubtedly, as well. "They have no wine." You know, you imagine her saying this to him, and the eyebrow going, "They have no wine." This knowing look. And he answered, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Now, we say, "Woman," well, that's kind of a harsh way to talk to your mother. No, at that time, that was a very respectful greeting or way to say it. It's different than our time now. You know, "What does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And she would have had an inkling of his hour. She knew there was a destiny here, but she also knew tone of voice. Notice what she says next. She turned to the servants and she says, "Whatever he says to do, do it." You know, in other words, what do you expect me to do? And she knew when he said what he said there, "What does your concern have to do with me?" that she knew he was going to do something, and so she told the servants, "Whatever he asks you to do, you go do it." Now there were 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. That's a lot, about 120 gallons. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." So they filled them up to the brim. And he says, "Okay, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." A wedding celebration, we do weddings in an afternoon. In those days, weddings lasted, a week sometimes, 5, 6, 7 days. And so you wanted to get married, you might have to put off getting married until you'd earn enough to have a wedding. Because they were fairly expensive, I think it would be safe to say. So they took it to the master of the feast. Now this would be one who was sort of the wedding coordinator from the, on the groom side. He asked the master of ceremonies, he looked after getting the food ready and all of those things. Might be a brother, might be somebody who was just really good at it. Anyway, he draws some out and takes it to the master of the feast, and they took some of it, and when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was turned into wine, and he didn't know where it came from, but the servants who'd drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. But you've kept the good wine until now. Now, he didn't get the guests drunk. When you have a taste of wine, your taste buds get satiated to a certain point. So if you really want to taste the really fine, fabulous wine, for those that enjoy really fine, fabulous wine, you want to have that on a clean palate. And then you get all the nuances of the flavor of the wine. So they would serve their best wine at the beginning because that would make a positive impression and it would be appreciated. Then later, after everybody had had various kinds of wine with the various meals during the course of the wedding feast, they would bring out their, you know, second-run, third-run wine. Vin ordinaire, as they call it in French. Ordinary wine. And they wouldn't really know the difference, nor would they care, because they'd already enjoyed the really, really good stuff at the beginning. Well, now the master of the feast, he said, this is amazing. You know, I thought you served your good stuff at the beginning. This is incredible! And you think so? What does that tell us about Christ? Well, this beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana, we have to finish verse 11, of Galilee, and he manifested his glory and his disciples believed in him. They were amazed at what he had done. They probably were standing there watching it happen. Now you stop and think about, well, why is this funny? Well, number one, there's this interplay between Jesus and Mary. You know, she says, they have no wine. As if she expects him to do something. He says, woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My time has not yet come. You know, she knew that. There was some destiny that he had. She'd hidden all that stuff she'd learned in her heart. But she also knew from the tone of voice that there was something he was going to do. Thus, she turns to the servants and says, whatever he says to do, do it. Now, it's possible. It doesn't say it here, but it's possible that as a kid, God had allowed him to do miracles, not on a public scale. But it's possible he had some experience in doing remarkable things like this, on a tiny scale, that Mary knew of. That's, you know, you have to wonder, you know, based on the interplay. There's that humorous interplay, that affectionate interplay between mother and son. And then, he doesn't just make a little wine so everybody gets a taste. He makes 120 gallons of wine. That probably was more than enough to go through the feast, and maybe they would get to keep some as a wedding gift. I don't know. And it wasn't just, you know, your Mogan David Blackberry wine that's so sweet it's like eating a Snickers bar minus the chocolate. This was really incredibly good wine. How funny is that? You know, he could have just made some, you know, regular Vin Ordinaire, but no. This has to maximize the flavor potentials of the wine. And you think, I wonder what that tastes like. Well, wait till the resurrection. I'll bet he makes some more. He has a recipe and all, you know. You get an idea of what Christ was like as a child based on what he was like as a young man. And he was funny, he was witty, he was in this case lovingly mischievous. You know, he could have put a little bit of, it could have been sangria with cayenne pepper mixed into the wine. It made interesting, a little hot, but interesting. But no, it had to be the very finest wine possible. He made many word plays. I've gone through those before. He loved and he quoted poetry, mostly the Psalms, but the beauty of poetry. He was funny. But that's not all. We also know that as a child he was serious-minded because he was a thinker. He was about his father's business. He took his family honor meant a great deal to Jesus. And yet for young people today, family honor often means very little. It is a blessing on the head of those who have some family honor. He focused on the kingdom of God. He was dedicated to the cause that he knew that his life would be given for. He understood the Bible, loved the Sabbath, studied and meditated and prayed. He attended the Sabbath and Bible studies at the synagogue, which was, you know, the precursor to the church. He fed mentally and spiritually on God's Word. He was kind-hearted. He even noticed baby sparrows falling out of the nest. You know, and use that as another analogy of God's concern for all mankind. He healed people sometimes purely out of compassion. Jesus was not weird as a young person. He could fit in. Fitting in wasn't what drove him. You know, we have too many that just, their peer pressure is the only thing that holds them up. And they have to fit in, or they, you know, can't imagine existing. Now, Christ dressed modestly in the common fashion of the day. He kept his hair short and well-groomed. We know that, not only from the fact that he said it is shame for a man to have long hair, but you can make a note of this and read it later. Ezekiel 44:20 is a prophecy of the priesthood in the millennium and the specific directions. They will not shave their heads, nor will they, but their hair will be well-trimmed. Well-trimmed. Christ was, again, he fit in. He could, and he often did, disappear into the crowd. Probably did that as a young person. He did not draw attention to himself. When he dressed well, but he didn't dress to make everybody want to stop and look at him. He had a lot of friends. He liked girls just fine. Had a healthy family, mom and sisters. He talked to the Samaritan woman at the well. He made sure that his mother was cared for when he was dying. But he never married. His life was dedicated to the kingdom of God and to all humanity. And he knew that he would be sacrificed, and that would be unfair to a young wife. But there was another reason why he didn't marry. He was already betrothed to the church. So he understood that his marriage was a different marriage that would come later. He knew that all as a young person, thinking about his future, looking forward to what there was to look forward to. Jesus Christ as a kid would have been fun to be around, safe to be around, fascinating and educational to be around. He would have been a true friend, faithful and loyal and helpful and inspiring. He would have been a friend that you would love to live for. But he came also to be a friend who you'd be so bonded with in the cause of the kingdom of God that you'd also die for. He was that kind of a friend. The disciples were like that. This mentioned right here at the end of chapter 2 of Matthew. Or sorry, of John, where we're at right now. He's talking about, ultimately, his coming sacrifice in verse 21. It starts in verse 13. But we get to the summary in verse 22. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had said. Those disciples, to a man, minus John, not only lived for what Christ was like as a kid, and therefore like as an adult, they died for him too. And John was ready to die for him, but he was the one exception of the original 12 that wasn't. So when you wonder what it would be like to have a friend, how could you relate to somebody who never sinned? I don't think we'd have any problem at all relating to Jesus Christ as a kid and as a young adult and later as an adult himself, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords.